I ask a question about the planets and so forth. We do have a space little thing here, don't we, in this net?
We sure do, and a guy named Vito has already signed in to discuss that subject. He's number one on the runway, Vito. Okay, hook the stop to check that at this time. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You're also going to be hearing John, KC2 WGB, and others. John and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic crew that meets most Sunday evenings on this frequency at this time to discuss things that are of interest to ham radio operators. That's what the TechNet does. We try to explain to people how antennas and transmission lines and propagation and transmitters and receivers, how all that stuff works. There's a whole lot to learn about wireless technology. The schools do a mediocre job of teaching it, particularly the antenna section of it, the transmission line section of it. By my standards, they do a mediocre job. They do it a lot better if they understood it a little bit better and put it into more meaningful illustrations from my point of view. The first portion of the TechNet, In the first portion, people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. The TechNet has been around for 29 and a half years, September of 1982 when it began. This is TechNet number 1410 of the series that began in September of 1982. So by now we believe people are listening in the tri-state area. This repeater has rather good coverage of northern New Jersey, southern New York, western Connecticut, Long Island, much of Long Island. So there's a lot of brain power in that metropolitan area of New York City. We try to tap into that brain power. So people sign in because they've got a question or a comment by giving us their name, their call letters, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment during the first hour. During the first hour, we do a sincere job of trying to give people at least a brief answer to their question. At the end of that hour, John goes to the mailbag, which used to be Mel's Corner. It's now John's Corner, where people who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have a rig by which they can get on the air and talk to us directly. The TechNet tries to answer people's questions in a live, give-and-take question and answer. John and I are not promising a written consulting service. We do it live, and so people who are not yet equipped because of license or equipment, they give John an email or a snail mail with their question, and we choose 2, 3, 4 of those that we cover at 9 o'clock. After the questions and answer, we go over to the space portion, where Paul WS2N, our space expert, tells us what NASA has been doing. Tonight's going to be a particularly exciting night for NASA. The so-called 7 Minutes of Terror you might have heard about. The Curiosity spacecraft, $200 million worth of hardware, 2 tons of hardware, something the size of a Volkswagen, is going to be landed on Mars tonight by our standards. Roughly 1 o'clock, 1:15 in the morning, our time is when it happens. And so by various websites you can go to and cable TV networks, and I'm guessing that the major networks are going to cover this because there's only one of these spacecraft. And during that so-called 7 Minutes of Terror, 79 pyrotechnic devices have to fire at just the right time. If any one of them fails or fires at the wrong time, most likely it's game over. And all of that takes place when the signal one way takes something like 12 minutes or 14 minutes to get here. The actual encounter with the atmosphere, where it starts off at 13,000 miles an hour, slows down to a couple of feet per second. In that 7 minutes, there's a whole sequence of heat shields, parachutes, sky cranes, and everything that has to work just right for this thing to land on the surface. Only one of these spacecraft, at $2.5 billion, you can sort of understand that. It's a super laboratory that's going to land on Mars and analyze soil, rocks, and whatever, look for the basic ingredients of early life on Mars. So at around 9:15 or so, Paul will be telling us the latest there and giving us hints as to where to go to get the latest information. Could be very exciting. If you have any interest in space at all, that's one of the most exciting things that NASA has done. There's no guarantee of success on this one. They've done the best they can to anticipate all the possible problems. It's such a complicated process. You'd be amazed how far Mars is away from us. I think it's like 250 million miles away at the time of the landing. One way, the signal and the speed of light takes 12 or 14 minutes to get here. So you can't help the thing along. By the time you see the signal, as they said, when you see the signal saying that it has first encountered the Martian atmosphere, the beginning of the 7 minutes of terror, by the time that signal gets down to NASA, because that signal is already 12 minutes old, it's old news, so to speak, the 7 minutes of terror would have already taken place. The spacecraft is either sitting on the surface of Mars in good condition, or it's a pile of rubble on the surface of Mars. It's going to take you another 7 minutes to find out what it is. So, good stuff. Alrighty, at this time we're going to take check-ins. Give me your call letters and name. We've already got Vito. Anyone else to check-in? Give me your call letters and name right now. KQRIW.
Dick, I'd like to add something to the monologue.
Go right ahead, John.
Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. As everyone knows, Dick and I enjoy your questions, whether you sign in or you email them over to the mailbag. There's one request I do make. First of all, the email address is juliabaker5, Oscar, at AOL.com. And just formulate a question, try to get it over to Dick, and we'll represent your questions. The only thing is, please do not ask Dick or I believe Dick agrees, to recommend a specific product, whether it be an antenna or a radio, because it is very difficult to do. You have so much subjective issues involved, such as size of the display you like, the layout of controls, how you're going to use it, even to holding the mic. My suggestion to you is, if you're looking for it, try to contact an Elmer or somebody who has a rig. Try it out, see if you can use it, how it feels, how it sounds. That type of thing is very important. So to ask for a recommendation, I don't think it's something that we can really do properly. Dick, you may have comments on that also, or some suggestions. So KC2WGB, back to you.
You're right on about it, John. Very difficult for us to make a recommendation. Because besides the criteria that John just gave you, there's a whole lot more criteria. What is your threshold of expenses? Besides buying a used piece of equipment and spending more than $150 is out of the question. To another guy who doesn't want to have somebody else's fingerprints and scratches on the front panel, spending $2,500 on a new piece of equipment is perfectly all right. So there's huge differences in finances, requirements. I like buying used pieces of equipment. I buy the so-called oldies, but goodies, because they've got a lot of capability without too many horns and whistles. Some of the modern-day equipment is so darn sub-menus, and so few buttons on the front panel, knobs on the front panel, that using it under real working conditions is less than desirable. From my point of view, I'm not a computer maven, as you can tell. So there's lots and lots of criteria. I sometimes make a kind of a suggestion when it comes to used equipment, 2-meter all mode. I mean, almost everyone on this repeater, 90-some-odd% of the equipment is a FM-only transceiver. Well, the whole non-2-meter band is 4 megacycles wide, and the approximate 2-megacycle region devoted to FM repeater and FM simplex is just half the band. There's another whole group of very high-tech people that use Morse code, single sideband, and so on. So when it comes to a 2-meter rig, do consider buying one that has all mode capability. Morse code, AM, single sideband, FM, narrowband FM, broadband FM, and so on. Well, many of those are wrapped up into a 1980 piece of equipment. Kenwood TS711A, that's what you're listening to, that I use. That happens to be one of my favorites. But it's a bunch of things I like. There's a bunch of things I like about it, but it's not for everybody. On the used market, you may be able to pick one of those up for $200 and to get the exact same number of requirements in a modern day piece of equipment, you'd have to pay over $2,000. Was there something else you were going to add to that one, John? K2LAW?
No, that's good enough, Dick. I think that explains it well. And there are so many variables, it's very difficult without personally knowing them, individually, what they're going to do. And you're right, money is an issue, and physical size, the way it appears. It's very hard to make a recommendation. Plus, I use generic recommendations for the claim. We're allowed to say equal to and specify a certain product, but never the product itself, as you KC2WGB. Oh, by the way, Dick, I do have to say, after all, I have a question on the last table. KC2WGB, thank you.
Pretty fine, John. You're on the list. And we're supposed to wait for all three teams. Stand by. All right, bud. There we go, all four. Okay, so we're going to take check-ins at this time. Anybody who's got questions or comments for the TechNet, please give me your call and the name and the word yes right now. K2LAW listening.
2-0, which is yes.
We got Rich and 2-EO. Anyone else?
Yes, Greg, KD2AWD. Yes.
WS Glenn Paul with us, Major Report. Good evening, sir.
Okay, and Greg, I think you are Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Whiskey Delta. Is that true, Greg Glenn? Correct?
Alpha Whiskey Victor.
Good thing I checked. Alpha Whiskey Victor. Okay. Rich Vito, Greg Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call letter name right now.
Online, books, papers, newspapers. it has to do with something, if I'm not sure, the lining up of the planets between the sun, I guess, and our all the planets of our solar system in the Milky Way galaxy. And I'm fearful and concerned that something dreadful, possibly due to the gravitational pull of other planets on our planet, will be responsible for tsunamis and earthquakes and possibly the loss of many thousands of lives. I'm just asking, I don't know, I'm not sure, let me drop. I don't know exactly what it's all about. I'm just fearful and wondering if there's anything to be fearful of. So that's what I want to know, if you have any insight on this this scenario. So back to you, Dick.
Yes, Vito, I think I have some insight on this, and I think there are other people on frequency who probably also have some insight, and we'll be probing them after I give my little say on what I think I know. This subject was approached, three quarters of a year ago at Stony Brook University, Stony Brook College, State University of New York, Stony Brook. They had on the very first Friday of each month during the school year something they call Astronomy Open Night, by which at 7:30 at night you go to their main lecture hall in the Earth, Space, and Science Center. And that lecture hall has a seat for 300 or 350 people. And there are times when they get a good subject like a black hole, so they'll fill the house up. And it's free of charge. You go there, go to Stony Brook University on the first Friday of the month. Check out the website just to make sure that they haven't moved the date, as they do sometimes. And so one of the subjects discussed was the so-called Mayan calendar, making a prediction that on December 20-something or other, sometime in December, the calendar runs out, the Earth is supposed to end, and all kinds of crazy alignments of the astronomical objects are going to create gravity gradient waves across the Earth. It's going to make they think it's going to make earthquakes. They think it's going to make all kinds of disturbances. No way in hell, as I see it, Vito. It's pure hokum. The chances of it being true are less than one chance in a million. I'm going to give you a little bit of an example as to why. After Copernicus finally did his thing and Galileo did his thing, we finally found out that the Ptolemaic system for explaining the universe, where we used to think, way back in the Dark Ages, up until 1600, we used to think that the Earth is the center of everything, and then there's a glass globe over the Earth, and all the stars are peppered on with the sun and the moon and everything. Everything is centered on to that sphere. They soon discovered that the sun is the center of this solar system, and the nine planets, what we thought at that time was seven or eight planets, or a handful of time, back down to eight. We decided that Pluto was a planetismal, not a full sized planet. Anyhow, we had all of these things going around the sun. So, of the solar system, things going around the sun, and the alignment of those planets are what Vito is discussing right now, what he's fearful of. And if you look at the space between those planets, the size of the planets and the spaces between the planets, you soon realize that the first four planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, are the ones closest to the sun. That's where the places where the distance between the planets is a small number by comparison of the other planets. So the dense portion of the solar system, where it's packed in real tight, are the first four planets. Now let's assume that Vito and I decide to make a scale model of the solar system. And by looking up the right books, you'll find that the Earth has got roughly 8,000 mile diameter. Mars has got a little bit more than 4,000 mile diameter. In other words, the diameter of Mars and the diameter of Earth are a 2-to-1 ratio. Mars is half the diameter of the Earth. Okay? If I'm trying to pick up two things that I'm very familiar with that have a 2-to-1 diameter ratio, I can use a dime and a 50-cent piece. So the dime represents Mars, and 50-cent piece represents the Earth. And I'm going to make the scale model, and I'm going to put them at just the right distance from each other. and then my scale model, I'm going to choose the period of time when this, when the Curiosity spacecraft, this Mars global, this Mars laboratory that's about to land in a couple of hours, I use the time that when Earth and Mars are the right distance apart, and I set up the scale model with 9 and 50 centimeters. What's the right distance between the two? 1/2 of a mile. I'm making the scale model of Mars and Earth at the time that Curiosity is about to land on Mars. And I set down the 50 cent piece, and that's the Earth, and I'm standing on it. And I have my buddy walk that dime 1/2 a mile away and set it down. Now the scale of sizes and the scale of distances are essentially accurate at that time. What NASA is really doing is taking the 2,000-pound, the 2-ton object back in last September. They took it off from the Earth. They took it off from the 50-cent piece, and they're going to land on the right letter of the dime 1/2 a mile away. That's the accuracy of the tractor. That's the dense portion of this solar system, the first 4 planets, and I've given you a scale model. So when you say that that space is nearly empty and the spaces between the planets are huge, that's an understatement. So the things are just because they sort of line up as far as what you can see with your telescope is concerned, and you think that that's going to make a great big gravity difference that the Earth is going to send. Mars is so far away that the amount of gravity you sense from Mars, the closest possible other planet, is zillions of times bigger than the amount of gravity you sense from our moon, which is smaller, but a hell of a lot closer, 250,000 miles versus 300 million miles. So just the moon going around is making all kinds of gravity characteristics, and tidal characteristics, and whatever. How much gravity you get from something, you can tell by how much tide it creates. You know how much tide the moon creates. How much tide does Mars create on Earth? You can't measure it, it's so damn small. So this alignment and all of these horror stories are pure hokum, and I think there's less than one chance in a million that anything is going to come out of it, Vito. And so I think you can stop worrying. Do some more reading. You will find articles that will give you some more of the facts. You'll find out it's no one's confused. Jim recognized. KD2BHY. Okay, we got you. So, as you can see, people have written sensationalistic articles because that sells magazines and newspapers. It doesn't mean it's real. Dig into the specifics. Astronomy is a great thing to study. One of the purest sciences in the world. When you get down to the real numbers, you'll find out it's very different than that. Sensationalistic articles, and I think you can rest easy on this one, and not lose any sleep over it, you know. Debate to PJF for any comments before we open up for other people on this one. Debate to PJF, you got it, Vito. P2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, very good, Dick. I have a better understanding now, a much better understanding. The gap, the space between the large and, all right, so I guess we'll be more concerned about the presidential election than about the financial area. Okay, thank you so much, sir. Back to you, Dave. I've learned a lot today.
Sounds like we got a happy customer there, John. I think we got a thank you bill. That's a joke. That's very true. Anyone else want any further comment on the alignment of the planets supposed to take place at the end of the world on December 21? Give me a call, that is right now. Yeah, I didn't think so. Okay, the next person with a question or a comment was Rich, N2EO. And he's a Johnny come lately to ham radio. Hasn't been around very long, but we let him come in and say a few words from time to time. That's a joke. You got it, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, thank you, Dick. K2LIW, Texan, Weimark, N2EO. Just, we had discussed a number of weeks ago, and I wanted to get into it further, the Collins 62S1 transverter. I mentioned to you they use a PI network output with a link coupling on 6 and 2. And you had suggested that the link may be undercoupled on 6 for a frequency, and that's why I'm getting more output on 2 than 6. Let me get a shot. So the only reason I'm concerned with a few extra watts is because I really would like to get 80 or 90 watts out of that thing to drive the C-500 to full output on 6 meters. I know when you powered kilowatt back in the late 70s, you used the flapper capacitor. There was a flapper coupled to the strip line. Now, I might have believed that, or assume that on this amplifier, I would use a lumped capacitor, maybe in series with a tuning capacitor, you know, a variable cap for the loading. And where would I tie it? To the high side of the power network coil, low side, center. Give me some insights here. K2LIW TechNet Limebox, MTVO. I wonder why Colin chose the link in the first place.
Okay, I'm hearing some conflicting terms, and maybe if G6 Delta Papadoulou is around, he might be able to clear it up for us. He calls it a link coupling, he calls it a PI coupling, and they really are kind of conflicting. PI has got a tuning capacitor from plate to ground, a series inductor, and another tuning capacitor from output to ground, which is the loading capacitor. That's a PI network. Link coupling is a very different looking physical arrangement, and both properly designed can do the job. Both of those as an output coupling network are capable of 98% efficiency of the coupling network. I'm not talking about of the tube now. I'm talking about of the coupling network. So it can waste very little of the power if they're properly designed. I use flapper tuning capacitors for tuning and loading on the half wavelength resonator on the so-called parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432 megacycles. Strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier, April and May 1972 QST. If you go to the archives, you can see that article. Thousands of those things have been built. A significant number of people used it for working moonbound. I was told that for a short period of time, one of those was on Air Force One as one of the standby transmitters. Anyhow, that kind of a transmitter with variable capacitor on the strip line, half-wave resonator for tuning and for loading. There's a couple of advantages of variable capacitor type loading, and that is it always works in one direction. It doesn't have a fold-back characteristic. Link coupling, by the way, PI networks also properly designed do not have fold-back. But a pure, let me drop it. A pure link coupling network really consists of some kind of a resonator connected between plate, B plus, and ground, which sets up a strong resonating electromagnetic field, a separate coil coupled to the first coil slash inductor is the output loading network, that's the link coupling, and by adjusting the spacing between the first coil and the second coil, and by adjusting the tuning of resonance of the second coil, those are the variables by which you adjust the amount of loading characteristic of your plate circuit of your amplifier. In order to get maximum power output and best efficiency, which are slightly different tuning, you want to have an ideal amount of loading. Also, when it comes to properly reproducing a single sideband signal to get the best linearity, you usually want reasonably heavy loading. And if the loading was too light, you get a kind of flat topping and other kinds of distortion that give you an increased third order intermodulation distortion on your single sideband transmitter. So proper loading is something you should have. And your loading control, what really is can really fool you with link coupling is that the link coupling gives you the heaviest loading when the link and its series capacitor as a independent network hits resonance. And that resonance might take place somewhere in the middle of that loading capacitor that's in series with that output link coupling. of the tuning of the capacitor. You haven't used the capacitor at maximum minimum. People get fooled into thinking that they found the point of optimum loading. That's the nasty characteristic of link loading. Only when you hit resonance do you get the maximum loading. That may happen in the middle of that loading capacitor tuning range. And if the spacing and the magnetic coupling between the first coil and the second coil is too light, that condition can be easily, if the spacing is too great, that can easily be too light a loading, even when you hit maximum loading on those tuning controls. So other means are required with link coupling to find out, are you getting proper loading? A very strong clue is, what is your wattmeter telling you? If it was a tetro tube, what is the screen grid current telling you? Because as you load a tetro tube more heavily, the screen current goes in the more negative direction, corresponding to light loading, screen grid current becomes positive. So screen grid current at the point of resonance of the plate surface, that's a strong clue as to whether or not you're getting proper loading. If it's a triode tube, it gets a little bit more complicated, but I believe many of the Collins transmitters use the 4CF250B, which is a tetro tube. If you have the ability to measure the screen grid current, then you can find out is the loading proper. So, now, you're asked how do you, in the simplest manner, do a redesign of the Collins transmitter, which operates on 62 meters, the transverter, I guess it is, in order to get proper loading. And I don't think with the raw data I've got right now, you're going to get an answer. We're going to have to dig a little bit deeper. You're going to have to do some more experiments or whatever, but at least to know what to look for. Screen grid current is the very first thing I would look for that's going to give you a hintage. N2EO, K2LIW in the deck end.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, you have to excuse me for being a little vague. You know, it's been a while since I've been into that circuit. What they have there is a coil. I believe they call it a pi-bar or pi-L. It's been a while since I've looked at it. And what they've got for the tuning, they've got a length of line that runs in a circle with a wiper. So when you turn the plate tuning, you're adjusting the inductance. It's kind of like the old inductomax sort of arrangement. And that works fine. Now, I have tried, but they've got it there. They've got a link coupling in that coil with a series resonant capacitor. That series resonant capacitor is the loading. I did optimize the link as best I could with the original. Got a little bit more output on 6. Now, I'm getting about 90, 95 watts out on 2. And about 60 watts out on 6. Like I say, that little bit of power doesn't normally concern me. It's a fraction of a dB. So I'm trying to drive a pair of 3500 on 6 meters, and that could be hundreds of watts. So maybe I'll have to dig a little deeper into the manual, Dick. Maybe I've made it clearer. K2LIW, Technet Limark, and 2EO.
If you can email me a common swept picture, what do we call that now? Put it on one of these copy machine type things that makes you an electronic copy. And if you can show me the physical layout of that plate circuit and the electronic schematic of it, I'm pretty sure I can make some suggestions for you, Rich, as to where to go next. And now, whether or not you get the assume that the rig is designed for 150 watts output, and you get 110 instead of 150, and real decibels of difference during the pileup, except for rare exceptions, that's not going to make a whole lot of difference. I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over it, but you like optimizing things, and I understand that. And by the way, you guys may know that last week we heard about Steve Polish, K1FO, who used to be WA1FFO in Hartford, Connecticut, now Madison, Connecticut. He passed away, but he was the designer and chief engineer of a company called Lunar Link. And Lunar Link made strip-line parallel kilowatt amplifiers for 432, 2 meters, and 6 meters, he made amplifiers. And the Lunar Link amplifier, when you go to his website, the one that's made for 6 meters, says for export use only. And so I think by that he's saying he will not sell the 6 meter kilowatt amplifier domestically. I'm kind of curious as to why. Maybe he's worried about the fact that with minor modification, the person could make that as a 1,000-watt transmitter on 27 megacycles. It's a 50-megacycle transmitter. I'm a little bit skeptical of that one. So if anybody knows why that transmitter made by Lunar Link, when he used to be alive, was made for export service only, I'd like to know. So if you can scan me a picture of that, Rich, I think I can make some suggestions. And to get into the open, K2LIW in the segment.
Okay, Dick, well, thank you very much. I will do that this week. I can scan them into the printer. I think I could do that and send you copies of the... I have a bunch of copies, and I'm not going to put you to work, Dick, but I'll send you a copy of the switch 62-meter output circuit, okay?
Sounds good. So it's a circuit that has the lack of loading and the schematic and the physical picture of it, if there is one, is what I'd like to see. The next person on our list was Greg, 2L Delta 2 Alpha Whiskey Victor. Go right ahead, Greg. K2LIW and TechNet. My name is Dick.
KD2AW TechNet. How you doing? My question is maybe old world, but I just can't get it in my head. Small volt DC circuit, battery. Pulling a 6.5 load. How do I figure out the ampere hour I need on the battery?
How many charge discharge cycles, a whole lot of variables. properly used, a good car battery will last you five years and sometimes beyond. Improperly used, you might have to replace it in 1 year. So ampere hours are what you're looking for. Divide your number of amperes into that ampere hours, and you'll know how many hours you've got on the battery if you fully discharge it. But then, after you do that calculation, that great, make a 2-to-1 adjustment on it, because you do not want to discharge the battery more than the 50% point, except for an emergency situation. If life and limb is at risk, you've got no way to charge the battery, you're on top of a mountain, you're doing emergency communication, and you worry about discharging the battery beyond the 50% point, stop worrying, go use it. But under normal circumstances, try not to discharge beyond 50%. Maybe some of that helps, but great. KD2AWV, K2LIW in the tech man. My name is Dick.
Yeah, okay, Dick, that does answers a lot. Now, this is the same theory for whether it be a deep cycle as well as an automotive type battery.
Deep cycle batteries are better on that territory. In other words, the amount of damage you do when you deeply discharge a so-called deep cycle, you do less damage. To my knowledge, you're still doing some damage. So any of these batteries, when you discharge them all the way, doing something that's partially destructive. On top of that, the deep cycle battery versus the non-deep cycle battery, the number of ampere hours you get per pound or per cubic foot, I think is slightly lower, so it's a trade-off. So you've got a little bit less energy on the deep cycle battery for the same size and weight, I think, but I'm not positive on that one. So even the deep cycle one, there is a disadvantage of going beyond the 50% point, I believe. Let's see if we have other people on frequency who have some battery knowledge that they'd like to give us right now. Please give me your call letters and name, K2RIW on the deck man. Maybe not, Greg. Maybe we don't have any battery experts here. There are a number of websites that will give you a lot of information about lead-acid batteries. So if you do a bunch of Google searches and the sub-searches to those, and I'm trying to think of some of the fancy words you should use, the way they put insulator between the plates is a fancy name they give to that kind of a battery. Anyhow, there's a lot of web information that's going to help, in my opinion. Back to you, Greg. KD2AWV, K2LIW.
WS, Glenn. Little info on that.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Many years ago, I had a vehicle, an old truck, and for a lot of reasons, problems with the electrical system. The battery would quit, you know. But so many times, like you said, about a half a dozen times, you're going to have some sort of problems with batteries. And I wanted to keep this thing running, so I got the idea to put a marine battery in there. And no matter how many times that thing would fail, that old vehicle, that battery kept on going. You know, the marine batteries are built, you know, really built for a deep discharge.
That's a good piece of information, Paul. Quite often you have a condition where there's intermittent error in the alternator of your automobile. I've had that where of the three windings inside the alternator, one of those three windings would develop a shorted turn. That would drag down the alternator from its normal capability of supplying 60 or 100 amperes. It would drag it down to where the alternator made a heavy winding sound in the transmitter when I was using it, and it would only supply about 3 amperes. And it would do this intermittently. In other words, I could bring the car to a shop. They would test the alternator. They would say, hey, it's working like a charm. It's producing 80 amperes of output. Stop worrying. Well, it would then go 2 days later into the shorter turn condition, during overheat or whatever, I'm not sure, where it could only turn out 3 amperes, depending on how much nighttime driving you're doing. You're eventually going to have a dead car battery. I remember coming back down from Albany one night when it went into that condition, and I really wanted to get the car home on a Sunday night, so I had to turn off the headlights while driving on the New York State Thruway. I don't recommend anybody do that. that the only way the 3 amperes out of that alternator would keep the car running, that I could get it all the way home. And thank goodness I was doing this very late at night, and the sun was going to rise eventually, and things became a little bit better. So there's an intermittent kind of a condition you can get. I once got it on a so-called rebuilt alternator. Drop. Where the rebuilt alternator, whenever you first installed it in the automobile and first turned it on, it cranked out the 80 amperes it was supposed to. But as soon as it got hot, it would jump down to 3 amperes because of the shorter turn condition. And I passed that alternator back to the place where I bought it from as a rebuilt. And they did a test on the spot, said it's perfectly all right, put it back in the box, put it on the shelf, gave me another one. In other words, that particular alternator, I'll bet you had recycled to 5 different people's automobiles, and it was handed back because each time they tested it, they only tested it for a brief period of time, and it looked like it was working like a charm. So there's some intermittent conditions you can get in an alternator that can drive you up a wall. The fact that your car battery went dead, either was telling you the alternator is not supplying the right amount of current when it needs to, and or there's some other mysterious discharging device going on in your car. In other words, you turn the car off, and you think the battery is not being discharged, something else is being left on, and the car is slowly discharging the battery. So one of those you've got to discover. It's a bunch of testing procedures. So a car that keeps killing its battery, it may not be the battery. I mean, it's like saying every time I blow a fuse, I'm going to put some fuse in it. Well, you're attacking the symptom, not the cause, if you know what I mean. Final on this one, great. KD2AWV, KQRIW.
K2RIW, KQAWV. I understand now what it's all about. I like the idea of the marine battery, as it seems to work better. But one way or another, you've answered my question. Thank you very much. Have a good night. Good night to all 73.
Very fine, Craig. Who is that?
N2ASS.
November 2, Alpha Sierra Sierra. If you've got a comment, start off with your name and tell us your comment, sir. Or if you want to be added to the list, tell me that. N2ASS, name first, K2LIW.
It's Greg over here. I just was wondering if the guy was having trouble with the battery discharge. I was just going to throw it out there that, these newer cars with a built-in regulator in the alternator, sometimes when they go bad, they'll put a small draw on the battery all the time. So the wind is blowing too loud, it'll slowly draw off the battery. So if you take one terminal off, you can see it's getting a little off there. I'm not too sure if that's what you guys were talking about. I kind of dropped in the last minute. That's all I wanted to throw out there.
That's a good thing for you to throw out, Greg. Yes. The diodes that do the rectifying that are inside of the alternator, they develop leakage that can be discharging your battery during the time the car is turned off. The built-in voltage regulator, the various nails by which it can become a failure. So I guess the guy doing a more thorough job will turn off his car with a good digital voltmeter connected to the battery and watch the voltage on the battery as a function of time. It gives him a clue. Or he disconnects one terminal of the battery and puts an ammeter in series with that terminal to the battery to find out how much of a load is the battery creating, is the car creating when the car is turned off. You got to be careful with that one now, because as you disconnect a lead from the battery, in some cases you're resetting the ignition control computer, you're resetting the clock, in some cases you lose all the programmed stations on the radio. Some pretty nasty things can happen when you disconnect a terminal on the battery, and whether or not that happens in the first second or 10 seconds later, I'm not sure. So there are various techniques. I guess a clamp-on ammeter. A clamp-on ammeter that has DC current capability. I own one of those. It's a slightly rare item. So measuring the current drain on the battery when the car is turned off with the right kind of instrumentation is a good thing to do as a clue of finding out what's going on. So not easy, but there's a lot of modes of failure that can happen if you kill your battery. Thank you for that one, Greg. Okay, Brian was the next person. KD2, Major Zulu Tango. Give us a brief transmission first to make sure you're in a good spot there, Brian. K2LIW in the second half. You got it, Brian. ahead. Real D-Y.
Yeah. Good evening there. This handle is John Delta. I have an HP laptop, right? And the battery they build in a certain circuitry that monitors the battery and stuff. And I'll charge it up 100% and disconnect it from the laptop. In under 2 weeks' time, the battery will discharge itself just because it has this internal circuitry monitoring the battery, which just seems like a really stupid thing to do. I don't know, in my opinion. And I don't know if anyone else has experienced that.
Yeah, the modern day lithium batteries have all kinds of, if it is a lithium battery, they have all kinds of protection circuits, because if you overcharge, undercharge, if you charge too vigorously, all kinds of things you can do with a lithium battery to create explosive atmospheres, and nasty things can happen. So modern day lithium batteries have some pretty fancy circuitry built into the battery itself to self-protect. Yes, I guess on a few occasions, very few occasions, that circuitry can be increased. Many of the batteries I've worked with, I've seen thousands of them go through a particular factory with no problem, and all of a sudden one particular battery has a failed regulator circuit, protection circuit. That particular battery sitting on a charger on the wall with a whole bunch of other batteries starts outgassing, and they evacuate the whole building until they correct the condition. Apparently the gas that comes off of a lithium battery could be kind of dangerous. So what was your method of diagnosing it? Did you just simply replace that battery? How did you fix the problem, Don? In 2LDY, K2LIW?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't fix the problem, it's a problem, you know. My older laptop, my Toshiba, I could unplug it, lose the battery in the laptop, and come back 2 months later, and the battery would be at like 80%. But the newer HP, I can't even, like, leave for a week without it discharging, you know, down to where I have to plug the laptop back in. I want to use it, so it's such a pain in the neck. And I called customer service, you know, and they weren't very helpful.
NY2H. Go right ahead. Find out about that, Lou. Back to you.
Yeah, Nick, well, you know, Google, a wealth of information. You've got to go through the information, see what's credible and what's not. And, you know, these problems aren't unique. This is a sign problem with a single line. You know, it repeats, it's repetitive. Somebody's going to have to have stumbled across it before you in the most probability.
Once you applied the remedy, I think you said you may have had to do it twice in a year. I mean, did the problem essentially go away, but then come back? back 6 months later? Give us a couple more words on that, Lou. Don, you need any fill on that? And I guess Don and Lou talk to each other during the week, so looks like you're eventually going to find the website you're looking for. N2LZY-H-U-L-A-W. Fine, Don, and come back and let us know how that works out. Brian is next. Kilo Delta 2 Zebra. Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Zebra Tango. Go right ahead, Brian. T2LAW. Okay, I think Brian might not be there. Jim was next. KD2BHY. What's going on in your neck of the woods, Jim? K2LAW.
Hi, Dick. I just had a question because today I'm on vacation here in Montauk, and today I tried the homebrew, actually a couple days ago, I tried the homebrew a 20-meter dipole. I got all the supplies a couple days before that, and it didn't turn out so good. I set it up against the house, and the SWR was 3-1. So I trimmed it a little bit, about half an inch, and then half an inch more, and measured it. And the SWR didn't really move. I mean, it kind of stayed at 3-1. And I didn't have, I was wondering, because I didn't have insulators on the end of the wire. I couldn't find them. So I was wondering, does that have to do with the SWR? And if you had any ideas why the SWR was so high, if I could possibly fix it.
Okay, I think I understand the situation there, Jim. A 20-meter dipole, which is the right physical length and the right electrical length, there's a slight difference between those, at a reasonable altitude, reasonably far away from other interfering objects, is capable of giving you something like a 1.3 or so standing wave ratio. As you bring tree limbs nearer the tips of the antenna, when you add extra capacitance, as you bring it up against the side of the house, as you bring it close to the ground, there's various things that can disturb the resonant frequency. The resonant frequency is the main thing you're looking for. And moving it each at a time is, in the case of a 20-meter beam, which is around 32 feet long, it's a very small percentage. If you realize that if the antenna is electronically too long or too short, it's going to give you a certain slant of standing wave ratio versus frequency. In other words, if you measure the standing wave ratio at 14.0, 14.1, 14.2, 14.3, 14.4, if it was legal, 14.5, measure those biswas at those frequencies. And if you see the slant going up, higher biswas at the higher frequencies, you know that the antenna is favoring the low frequency, if it's acting electronically too long, or if it slants the other way, if it gets lower and lower standing wave ratio, and you go up in frequency, then you know it's too short. So looking at cutting an inch at a time is difficult because you can't easily put it back. And by the way, cutting an inch at a time is not the right way to go. If you don't have the egg insulated for the chip, and hopefully you've got, hopefully you've got a good insulator in the center where your transmission line is connected. And it would be nice to have some kind of a balancing device there. And maybe your balance device is a mechanical connection and center insulator and support all at once. That would be a nice way to go. And the tips of the dipole don't have to go to egg insulators. You can curve them back on themselves with a loop, a twisted loop, and then pick up a piece of insulated material, rope, twine, whatever, insulated material at the ends of the dipole, part of the support, are perfectly good as egg insulators. There's nothing magic about the egg insulator. But if you really want to change the length in a non-restrictive manner, you could be readjusting those loops on the end. Or if you had a bunch of clip leads, if you think the antenna is too short, obvious by the standing wave ratio getting lower as you go higher in frequency, that's indicating the antenna is too short, and you simply put clip leads on the end and adjust the clip leads in various ways, you can electronically lengthen the antenna without disturbing the copper wire itself. If the antenna was right in the center of the band the way you like it, and you sweep it in frequency at each one of those frequencies, you measure the standing wave ratio, and you plot it, you'll get a bathtub-shaped curve, a U-shaped curve, with the lowest as well in the center. Then you've got the electrical length right for that environment. So that kind of testing is going to give you some strong clues, as I see it, Jim. And where it's suspended, if it's close to the ground, up against the building, if the tips of the dipole are close to trees, all of these things, air capacitance, tend to lower the resonant frequency antenna and make impedance matching a little bit more difficult. So I think you're going to find out a lot with that frequency sweeping Vizwar test. 82 DHY, D2LA in the tech map. Glenn recognized, and stand by, Jim, because I bet you Glenn has been there, done that, and he's got some good suggestions. Go ahead, Glenn.
Once I knew what the weight was,